Hi there, my name is Dr. Thomas Round. I'm the RCGP e-learning development lead. And today in this podcast, I'm having a chat with Nicholas Jones, who's a GP colleague from Oxford with a specialist interest in cardiovascular disease. Hi, Nick.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Just tell us a little bit about your background and career.
I'm a salary GP in a central Oxford practice. And like many of us these days, I combine that with some different roles. So I've got an interest in cardiology, as you mentioned. So I work through our local heart centre doing outpatient cardiology clinics. And I also have a position at the university in Oxford undertaking primary care research on cardiovascular disease, where I have an NIHR funded position. So I'm particularly interested in atrial fibrillation and heart failure. But of course, there's a lot of crossover between those two conditions and other sort of cardiovascular diseases, including pertinent to today, lipid management, which seems to, you know, be relevant to lots and lots of our patients in primary care, doesn't it, Tom? I think this is one of those things that none of us can get away from. If you're going to be a GP, lipid management is going to come into your work.
Absolutely. Today's focus is on primary risk assessment and lipid management in general and cardiovascular disease. And to link to that, we have a module which you wrote on the college website and also a BJGP article, which we can link to.
Yeah, that's right. It should be freely available. It was published in the BJGP sometime late last year. One of the things we tried to do with that, wasn't it, Tom, was to put in a couple of flow charts, which I think are helpful because there is quite a bit in the lipid management about sort of different targets and when to add in other medications, which we'll go through today. But hopefully that's a useful reference if you want to look back about when to intensify treatment or what to add on. Then we've got these two flow charts in there, which break it down between primary and secondary prevention.
Absolutely. So a lot of us in GP will be used to cardiovascular disease risk assessment and primary prevention. What does primary prevention mean in simple terms?
I suppose primary prevention is thinking about trying to reduce anybody's risk of having a future cardiovascular event, and that might include a stroke or a myocardial infarction. The distinction there is between somebody who's already had an event with sort of established disease. So once you've had your MI or you've had your stroke, then you fall into that secondary prevention category. So that's the delineation which the guidelines currently make, and which at face value seems to make sense, although the more you sort of start thinking about it and digging into it, you find that there are lots of blurring edges around, you know, when does primary prevention become secondary prevention, I think, which is interesting. You know, the guidance absolutely says primary prevention, you've not yet had an event, secondary prevention, you have.
Absolutely. So I guess it's a clear event, we get a discharge summary, someone's had a MSTEMI, MI type admission or a stroke or something like that, then we're thinking about definitely they need the secondary prevention. I guess it blurs the boundary a bit when we're considering those routes to risk assessment, which obviously we've got the cardiovascular health checks above 40, 45, right, where we bring people in kind of primarily run by your HCL nurse. They do the blood pressure, they do cholesterol to enable us to do a Q-risk score. But we may see more of these incidental findings coming in. So maybe from CT scanning for lung cancer screening, or maybe patients referred into chest pain clinic, but no inducible ischemia. I find that quite common, seems to come back, but they get a calcium score.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there within the primary prevention cohort, there is a huge range of patients' risk for cardiovascular events. And we sort of all know that intuitively, but you could try to quantify that in different ways. So you might look at levels of Q-risk score. And we know, of course, that the higher the Q-risk score, the higher your 10-year risk of a cardiovascular event is, which is why there's so much emphasis on trying to treat people with a Q-risk score above 20%. But Q-risk is just one way of identifying people who are at risk of future cardiovascular events. So people who are referred to chest pain clinics who are not found to have obstructive coronary disease, sort of causing angina, those people still seem to be as a cohort at some increased risk of future cardiovascular disease. If you have individuals who go on to have a CT coronary angiogram as part of their chest pain assessment, as you said, perhaps they're not found to have obstructive coronary disease, but they may have mild to moderate atherosclerosis. Well, they are at some degree of increased risk compared to people with no atherosclerotic disease at all. And as you mentioned, we're seeing a huge number of people going through the new lung cancer screening program who are having CT chest done and being found to have coronary calcification picked up through that, which is a little bit different as a process. So atherosclerosis and calcification, slightly different disease processes. So at the moment, all those people with coronary calcium scores being picked up through lung cancer screening, we're recommended to consider them under the primary prevention banner, obviously, unless they've had a separate event. But even if you get someone who's picked up with moderate to severe coronary calcium who hasn't had an event, then they're still still considered in the primary prevention category at the moment in terms of their future risk assessment. So it's interesting, isn't it? And I think that's perhaps one of the things that this new NICE guideline is trying to get at, is that we've previously had this way of thinking about cardiovascular risk assessment of waiting for people to get to a certain level of risk in the primary prevention cohort, largely based on when their Q risk goes above a certain threshold. And the previous iteration of the NICE guideline, that had been 10%. But if we think about Q risk, you know, we'll all know by calculating it that it's very heavily weighted on patient's age. So if you are a man and you're in perfect health otherwise, you've never smoked, you've got no significant family history, you're on no medication, I think it's the age of 66 when your Q risk crosses the threshold of 10%. So just through age alone, and similar in women. So we know that age very heavily weights Q risk scores. And I think that perhaps some of the problem with the traditional or the previous way of trying to modify people's longer term risk of cardiovascular events was that we were waiting for people to almost reach a certain age and level of risk before we'd start intervening. Whereas perhaps the new guideline is trying to get us to think about people's longer term lifetime risk and saying, might we be able to identify some people who are at higher risk at a younger age to start intervening at an earlier stage and therefore reduce the longer term risk. And there is good data to back that up. So we know that if you don't intervene, if someone has a high LDL cholesterol, for example, that's detected in their 30s or 40s, and you leave them with that high cholesterol over many years, 20 to 30 years of follow-up, they were at significantly increased risk of cardiovascular events compared to someone whose LDL is 1.8 or below the treatment target. So we know that LDL cholesterol is a direct cause of atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, and intervening early therefore does make sense in terms of reducing people's lifetime risk. But younger people will often have a Q risk score that's low, and that's one of the problems with relying on that alone. So I think there's lots of different ways that we can try to estimate this risk, and I think part of the sort of challenge for us in primary care is about how we can do that and perhaps individualize it. You know, are there patients who we might want to intervene in early? And of course, do those patients want that treatment is another thing, and I think that's really interesting. Perhaps we're going to touch on, Tom, there is quite a lot of debate about primary prevention as well, isn't there? I don't know, there was a BMJ article that was published just before Christmas debating about the amount of time and effort that we should put in primary care in focusing on primary prevention, which is an interesting debate, I think.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I guess it does come absolutely into potentially over-treatment, over-medicalization. As you said, if you're a healthy man at 66, do you want to have to take a statin? You know, that individualized risk discussion. But I guess from another viewpoint, it is useful to have that discussion, not just the cholesterol, around lifestyle factors, assessing family history, thinking about smoking, thinking about other risk factors, potentially for cardiovascular disease, but that overlaps with other diseases. I'm interested in cancer, and all these risk factors are quite relevant for cancer as well, risk reduction.
Yeah, absolutely. And I try and frame those discussions in that way, because I think a lot of lipid management guidelines focus on targets, cholesterol reduction or non-HDL or LDL targets. And I think we have to be clear that often trying to achieve those targets and to maintain those targets through lifestyle interventions alone can be difficult. However, that doesn't mean that those wider lifestyle changes are not important. If you manage to lose 10% of your body weight, if you're someone who has significant obesity, and if you're someone who smokes and you stop smoking and you begin exercising more, all those things can have profound impact on your longer term health, even if they don't quite manage to get your cholesterol level down to target. And, you know, they may do, but I think it's an important point to make to patients that we should think about health holistically, and that there's lots that patients can do themselves to maintain and protect their own health, and that relying on medication alone is rarely the right thing to do.
Absolutely. I guess the most common one might be we might get a cholesterol result. And my kind of way of looking at that is the age of the patient and also trending it. Often I find cholesterol's a little bit borderline raised. Don't know if it's just my population. So then I'm thinking, okay, what's the last Q risk score? Can I calculate that? And then kind of making a decision, do we need to call the patient in? Maybe sending some digital tools and some information, bringing them in to see the nurse or the healthcare assistant for a further discussion. Is that sort of how you'd frame it? I use one system of EMIS, but there's other systems out there, and we have QRisk 2. We don't have QRisk 3, which would require a separate login to the website. So that's also that issue around sort of workflow, I guess.
You know, in the different GP systems we use across the UK, I think embedded in all the primary care software systems, certainly in EMIS, which I use, it's still relying on QRisk 2, or Optum, I should say now, is relying on QRisk 2. So nice to acknowledge that because of that reason, you can still continue to use it. Although it's worth saying there's actually QRisk 4 as well now, the latest iteration, which is nowhere near being embedded, I'm sure, into sort of routine practice. So there are a few risk factors which have been added into the more novel iterations of QRisk, which therefore won't be in. So it's worth worth recognizing that there are certain patients who may have their QRIS score underestimated by relying on QRIS too. For example, people on certain medications like antipsychotics, or people with severe mental health problems, people with HIV, for example. So there are certain groups of patients where the QRIS 2 is slightly behind, but you know, they're relatively few. I think at an overall population level, it's still reasonable to use it.
That's very useful, Nick. I mean, we just had a recent podcast looking at physical health in serious mental health illness. Exactly that issue came up around actually in people with long-term antipsychotics. Definitely the current embedded one would underscore.
Yeah, and I think that is an at-risk population, isn't it? I think there are certain risk populations where there is a danger that this population level automated approach might underdo it for them, that we might be sort of under-treating those people. And that's a challenge. And I suppose something that we need to be aware of, you know, certainly at an individual GP level, that if we're seeing those patients for, say, a mental health review, but their QRIS score is coming out at 8%, say that actually they may have a more significant risk than that's sort of suggesting. There are a couple of other specific risk groups where it's not recommended to do QRIS, which are probably worth commenting on. For example, people with familial hypercholesterolemia or chronic kidney disease, for example, where there is a separate guidance about when we should be thinking about initiating lipid lowering therapy. But I agree with you. I think the way that we generally approach this or in our practice is if patients have a cholesterol level checked, we're going to input that data into a QRIS score, usually QRIS 2, so that it's automated. And then we're going to get that 10-year risk score. And, you know, we're going to categorize that into those different boundaries. So over 20% being particularly high risk, then over 10%, and then down to over 5% as lower risk threshold. And I think one of the interesting changes that has come about through this NICE guideline is that now people with a QRIS score below 10%, NICE say that we should not rule out offering them statins. And this is something that really hit the national press, because potentially that makes many millions more, and particularly younger people, eligible for having a statin. I think the wording is quite important there. So when NICE say do not rule out, that's a fairly weak recommendation from NICE. I mean, I think probably what they're getting at there is that sort of opportunity to individualize our treatment in that younger cohort, so that perhaps, you know, I've had people who've come into me where they've had a first degree relative who's had a cardiovascular event at quite a young age, and perhaps they're very motivated to do anything they can to help protect themselves against future cardiovascular disease, and you get a cholesterol level back and it maybe is 5.5 total cholesterol, non-HDL is 4.4 or something, quite elevated really. Certainly someone who, you know, over time that they're going to get a QRIS score above the 10% threshold, you might want to talk to them about starting a statin earlier, along with those lifestyle steps that we've spoken about already. So I think that's one of the key changes there, is thinking about the younger cohort and their lifetime risk. And there are lifetime risk calculators, QRISK have one, where you can input data to say what's this person's lifetime risk of a cardiovascular event. And also you can change that by saying, well, if we gave someone a statin and we reduced their non-HDL cholesterol from 4 down to 2.5, say, what would that do in terms of their long-term cardiovascular risk? And that can be quite helpful in terms of informing those discussions. There are also patient information leaflets available. So NICE have given one about sort of statin decision making, which can be helpful to send to patients before they come in, because it can be quite a long and detailed discussion, I find. I don't know if I overdo it, but there's quite a lot once you start thinking about lifestyle factors, statins, what the scores mean, what the sort of risks and benefits of treatments might be. I think there's quite a lot potentially in there. I think prepping patients before they come can be a helpful way to help manage that.
I completely agree. And I think obviously we have to tailor our consultation to that individual patient's health literacy level, English level, education level. So it is a complex decision making. We obviously have shared decision aids, and I think there's quite a lot of research into that, using those different smiley faces and, you know, other tools that help patients make those decisions. And using digital technology can be helpful as well, as you say, prepping a patient, sending them some information, go away. Like all these things, it's a sort of discussion over your lifetime risk, isn't it? Or your 10-year risk, rather than that immediate risk we have to do something here and now.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's right. It's not about sort of short-term interventions. There's definitely time to think about these things and make an informed decision. I think the other things I would say about that is, one, just perhaps find a way that works for you as an individual. You know, I think some people really like explaining using the smiley face tools and the sort of red and green circles as a way of estimating risk. But as long as you've got a way that works for you, that's probably the most important thing. And the other thing is, I think, you know, to recognize, we're sort of touching this already with QRISK underestimating risk sometimes, that these scores are not a perfect science. You know, they are population level scores, and although they've been validated in primary care populations, you know, what we're trying to do is to come up with a treatment plan which works for that individual patient in front of us. And every patient who walks through the door is going to have their own preconceptions and thoughts about their attitude towards risk and towards taking medication, and we're there to sort of guide them with that evidence-based medication. But it's an individual decision, isn't it?
Any top tips on interpreting cholesterol results?
Yeah, I mean, people may be getting cholesterol results in different ways. I think the things that I particularly focus on are the non-HDL and the LDL cholesterol. So non-HDL is a sort of grouping of the most atherogenic different types of cholesterol, including the LDL within that. And I particularly focus on that because they are the more atherogenic ones. Also, they're the ones which are the sort of targets that we're aiming for. The other things that are of interest is, of course, the total cholesterol level. Triglycerides are important as well. So, you know, you may see someone with a more isolated raised triglyceride level. That can be something which can be missed in the QRIS score, which doesn't take triglycerides in. You know, it's looking at the cholesterol ratio particularly. So that's something to pay attention to, that if cholesterol ratio looks normal, but they've got raised triglycerides, that may still, you know, sort of identify them at being at a higher risk. Just touching on that as well, we know that familial hypercholesterolemia is underdiagnosed at a population level in the UK and is actually quite prevalent. I think probably around one in 500 people in the UK are estimated to have it. And so looking at that total cholesterol score, and particularly if patients have got a score of sort of 7.5 or higher, or actively inquiring about family history of high cholesterol levels diagnosed at a young age, certainly to try and identify people who might benefit from referral and assessment to those particular clinics, because that is a higher risk group as well, and one where there's separate guidance. So that's something where they're focusing on the total cholesterol level is important. But I think the main things here are looking at the level and being interested in them in younger people, as we've mentioned. You know, so if you've got someone who's got a total cholesterol of 6.5 and they're 40, they may have a QRIS score, which is still quite low, but obviously, you know, that is a higher level of cholesterol for them. And that may be something which we can't file as no significant action needed, even if their QRIS score is 4. I think we might need to flag to that patient that although we're not recommending them perhaps treatment at this stage, we do need to think about that as a risk factor over the longer term.
And as we said, even brief intervention can help with lifestyle reduction risk.
Brief intervention can. I think it's also the importance of not doing nothing. Do you know what I mean? I think sometimes if we don't say anything about a cholesterol result, that carries its own meaning to patients. They may well walk away thinking, well, I haven't heard back about that, and therefore it's probably my cholesterol levels are fine. You know, so even raising the possibility that the cholesterol level is perhaps higher than typical for someone in their age group can be an important thing to bring to the patient's attention.
Going now into sort of treatment. So we've done our QRISC, we've done an individual discussion with the patient. Patients maybe gone away and thought about it, but then lets us know maybe I want to start a statin or I want to try it out. So there's a lot of myths around statins, aren't there? Patients get worried about them. So NICE recommends atorvastatin first line 20 milligrams, if I remember correctly, as primary prevention. But of course, then I think maybe whether some of these side effects are overstated, or how would you explain that to a patient?
So I think it is obviously important to discuss potential for side effects. You know, I think side effects with statins are quite common, or certainly commonly reported. But what I try to do with patients is to talk about how common a lot of the reported side effects are, even in people who are not taking statins. So there was a large meta-analysis done pooling a number of the big statin blinded randomized trials. And in that, they found that about a third of patients randomized to statins reported side effects from the statins. You know, the common things that we're all familiar with: indigestion, muscle ache, fatigue, for example. But about 20 to 25% of people in the placebo group also reported those same side effects. And, you know, another study estimated that up to 90% of reported muscle symptoms that are reported as side effects from statins are actually not directly statin related. So there's probably quite a powerful sort of nocebo effect here. You know, the idea that you're expecting side effects from starting on statins because there's been so much public attention on that. And therefore, you know, you'll be on the lookout for those things. You're likely to attribute any muscle ache to the statin if you started it. Whereas in fact, at a population level, certainly statins in general are very, very safe medications. So I don't mean to say that everyone's going to tolerate a statin. We all know that's not true, you know, and certainly there are people who you can start a statin, they'll have terrible muscle ache, you stop it, that goes away, you try again, the muscle ache comes back, you know, statins won't be for them. But I think we need to try to put that in proportion. I think in general, the risks of serious side effects have probably been overestimated, certainly by the mainstream media. So trying to give information about that at the outset can be important. I think the other things to say with statins are it's better to be taking some dose of statin than none at all in terms of treatment prevention. So if you start on that 20 milligrams of atorvastatin but the patient doesn't tolerate it, you can certainly try 10 milligrams and see if they tolerate that. You can even try alternate day statins. You know, it's trying to find a regime that works for the patient is okay. And if you could get someone established on 10 milligrams and they can take that for 6 months, then you may be able to think about intensifying that further down the line. But trying to start something is really important. And I suppose it is perhaps a good moment just to reflect on how effective statins are, because I think there is a lot of this negative press around statins, both in terms of is it really worth our workload effort in general practice at focusing on primary prevention, or, you know, what about these many side effects that patients report, but we know that statins are incredibly effective drugs at lowering cholesterol levels. They tend to reduce your non-HDL cholesterol by around sort of 40% in general. And we also know that reducing people's LDL cholesterol by about 1 millimole is equivalent to reducing long-term cardiovascular risk by 15 to 20% or so. So this is important stuff, particularly when you think about the number of patients this is pertinent to across the population. So I think statins are the sort of mainstay of treatment because of their clinical effectiveness and also because of their safety. We've spoken a bit about the sort of side effects of statins. There are, of course, more significant adverse effects that you can have from statins, myositis, transaminitis, for example. Those things are really pretty unusual. One in several hundred people who take statins, you know, might have a raised transaminitis from taking the statin, or one in several thousand people might have a serious effect of myositis. Probably number needs to harm about one in 250 people for diabetes, which is something that there's been more focus on recently. So interestingly, taking statins do increase your risk of developing diabetes, but again, by quite a small proportion. And when you look at that against the treatment benefit you get in terms of cardiovascular risk reduction, it seems certainly outweighed by the treatment benefit, particularly when you think with diabetes, of course, one of the main things you're trying to prevent is cardiovascular events.
That's super interesting. I think all those top tips, I think I use in my practice as well. Maybe some patients who are worried, or, you know, maybe tried before. We get quite a lot of patients like that, don't we? Try the statin, not sure I like it. Maybe trying that 10 milligrams or trying alternative days. Or sometimes I use rosuvastatin potentially. And I guess also, what do we start a statin and just let a patient go? Or should we do some follow-up review after a few months?
Yeah, thanks, Tom. Like that leading question, it helps me focus on where we're going. I mean, I think you're sort of hinting at the change that is coming in lipid management here. In the old days, we used to do, they termed fire and forget. You know, you'd sort of fire off your prescription of atorvastatin and you could feel happy that job was done. And unfortunately, the new guideline is asking a lot more of us, because now very clearly the recommendations are we should try to treat patients down to targets. And this is true both in the primary prevention and secondary prevention setting. So if you have someone who is in the sort of primary prevention figure, then we're aiming for a 40% reduction in their non-HDL cholesterol after starting a statin. And if you are in the secondary prevention cohort, then we are aiming for a specific target, which is a LDL cholesterol of 2 or lower and a non-HDL cholesterol of 2.6 or lower. That's the UK target. Europe suggests that people should go further. They suggest an LDL target of at least 1.8 or a non-HDL of 2.5. NICE looked at that and decided that there would be too much workload to try to achieve that small incremental difference from 2 to 1.8 as an LDL cholesterol target. But it's certainly worth bearing in mind that 2 is a fairly conservative target that NICE have set when you look at different international guidelines about how far we should be going. And I suppose the sort of thinking behind that is that there's a fairly linear relationship between our LDL and non-HDL cholesterol levels and our long-term cardiovascular risk. And it's very hard to get down to a low level of LDL cholesterol, say, where you start having an increased risk of other adverse effects. So in general, it really is the lower the better with lipids. So if you've got someone who's keen to protect themselves further against cardiovascular events, you really can't do them a disservice by trying to intensify their lipid management. It's a real cornerstone of cardiovascular risk protection.
So that's quite a big change, isn't it? Because we just used to do fire and forget. I would probably still do that a bit, given the pressures on primary care. But as you say, it's probably that individualized decision making. Have they got other comorbidities? Are they going to have bloods in the next 3 to 6 months anyway? And there's a sort of time period that you would, you know, what's the evidence on? You've had that initial cholesterol, had that discussion, started a statin. When would be an optimal time, say, if someone wanted to sort of recheck bloods?
Yeah, it is a huge change, isn't it? And I think there's a huge amount of work associated with this. And I think we probably need to work out within our practices about who's going to be doing that. We've been fortunate, our practice, to recruit 3 pharmacists who have now taken on a lot of this follow-up of lipid management work, intensification of lipid-lowering therapies. So, you know, that type of practice and system approach, I think, is really important. And you're absolutely right, Tom. I don't think this is something that we've really done very well, you know, as a profession in terms of managing lipids. So I saw some data from 18 months or so ago, audit data saying that amongst the secondary prevention cohort, so, you know, the particularly high-risk group, there was still at least 2/3 of patients who weren't having their cholesterol levels treated to those NICE recommended targets. So there's a huge number of patients who have been started on probably the correct starting treatment dose, but haven't had the lipid management intensified in the way that the guidelines are currently recommended to do that. The suggestion in terms of how we do it is that we initiate therapy and then we repeat a cholesterol level after 2 to 3 months and then check against those targets that I mentioned about whether we've achieved them. And if we have, then really probably don't need a lot of long-term monitoring of cholesterol levels. You know, perhaps people would say do another one at 1 year follow-up to check that the control is still there, but you probably don't need an annual lipid check once you've achieved the target. So that might be a way of minimizing some work that people might be doing, recalling people back to check their lipid levels are still controlled every year. Actually, the treatment effect you get from medicines like statins or ezetimibe, it seems to work quite quickly. So, you know, certainly by 2 months, you would expect to see most of the treatment effect of the statin already there. So I think that I would be thinking about trying to recheck a blood test within a couple of months and maybe tying that in with the prescription that you give the patient. So you might say, look, I'm going to give you a 2 or 3 month initial prescription for the 20 milligrams of atorvastatin. And when you're coming to the end of that prescription, make sure that you've booked a blood test so that we can check what your cholesterol level is, see what impact that's had, and determine whether you need to have the dose adjusted or not. And probably preparing for people, you know, at that initial consultation, that we are going to try to get them down to a level of cholesterol and the rationale for doing that. And I think, you know, it makes sense intuitively. So hopefully that's not a hard sell to patients, saying that we're going to try to get your cholesterol down to a certain target. I think people sometimes quite like that approach of saying we're going to do this and find a dose that's right for you, rather than just saying, look, everybody in this situation gets 20 milligrams of atorvastatin. I think for patients, showing that we're trying to get treatment actually personalised for them is a good thing.
That's really helpful. Thank you. As I say, maybe tying in if they've got hypertension with a hypertension review, or if they've got CKD or diabetes, sort of tying it in. And I guess with different targets, if you've got diabetes, etc., with your with the risks. Yeah, just then also thinking about what to do. Obviously, we might intensify and we can go to a maximum of 80 milligrams potentially of atorvastatin. I mentioned rosuvastatin as a potential option for some patients. You mentioned ezetimibe and other agents and maybe when to refer.
The first thing to do is try to get them on the highest intensity statin that you can. If they can't tolerate a statin, and there's a separate statin intolerant pathway that you can have a look at through NHS England, which is easily sort of searchable online, but get them to the highest dose of statin that they can tolerate. And then if their cholesterol levels still are not controlled, that's when you would add in ezetimibe. Ezetimibe is not as effective at lowering cholesterol as statins are, but it does have good effect. And it's also got clinical outcome data. You know, it does reduce people's risk of cardiovascular events as well. So single dose of ezetimibe, 10 milligrams, so quite easy to add on. Tends to be quite well tolerated, not significant interactions with statins, so absolutely fine to use the two of them together. And people should be able to prescribe this directly from primary care. So in either the secondary or primary prevention setting, if you haven't been able to achieve the desired reduction in the non-HDL or LDL cholesterol level, then add in ezetimibe. And then it depends a bit where you're at after that. So if the patient is on a high intensity statin, say, and ezetimibe, and you're still not achieving the target, then that would be a situation where you might think about referring to secondary care. And then we've got different options now, things like inclisiran is obviously coming in, or we've got other PCSK9 oral medications. Local pathways may slightly differ. I know some people are initiating inclisiran in primary care now, so that would be a very reasonable third treatment for patients who have not achieved those target levels of LDL or non-HDL cholesterol with that high intensity statin plus ezetimibe. That's the point when you think about inclisiran as an add-on. I suppose the other thing to touch on is bempedoic acid. So the UK guidelines largely focus on this amongst people who are intolerant of statins. So imagine, you know, you found someone and they truly can't take any dose of statin at all, then you would put them on ezetimibe. Quite likely ezetimibe alone might not achieve the desired reduction in those cholesterol levels. So that will be an indication to add on bempedoic acid at that point. And then, you know, the same if you're not achieving the targets on that combination therapy of ezetimibe and bempedoic acid, then you could look at adding in inclisiran or one of the PCSK9 inhibitors.
And certainly it's then, as you say, think about referral advice and guidance, etc. But I think it's, as you say, it's a guideline is only a guideline. Thinking about actually your clinical decision-making, your experience, shared decision-making with the patient, and as you say, thinking about what works for them.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's really important. It's also, I think, something that we still lead on in primary care, or we need to lead on, is the stepping up and stepping down of treatments in this figure. You know, this isn't going to be something that secondary care really do. They may well start a high intensity statin in a patient who's had a coronary event, say, at the time of discharge, but this longer term lipid management is going to fall within our remit. And I think, interestingly, once people get towards the end of life and later years as well, I think we need to think about stepping down treatment as well, because there's a lot of uncertainty about the evidence evidence base for statins in people, for example, over the age of 85. And I think de-prescribing is something that perhaps not really focused on much in national guidance around lipid treatment, but something that we're all aware of the importance of that in primary care. So, you know, certainly if you've got a patient who's had a long-term treatment with a statin for primary prevention, but now they're in their 90s and they've developed another cancer and you're thinking their prognosis is maybe only a couple of years or so, you know, absolutely thinking about stopping the statin is the right thing to do in that scenario as well. So it's about tailoring that treatment decision, both when you're initiating therapy, but about when it might be the right time to stop it too.
Thanks, Nick. And any sort of final summary top tips from yourself?
I think the main things in terms of the changes in the guidance are thinking about younger patients and their lifetime risk. So that's one key takeaway message, even if they've got a Q risk score below 10%. I think the second thing I would say is about the importance now of treating to target in both primary and secondary prevention. I think the third thing I would mention is around trying to make sure that patients are aware about how effective statins are and about their safety overall. And the final thing I would say is about trying to develop practice systems for doing this, because it's a huge amount of work given the number of patients it is eligible to. So thinking about your own practice workflows, you know, how are you going to deal with those cholesterol levels when they come back? Who's going to be responsible for follow-up of patients and intensifying treatment? Having a team approach is really important.
Yeah, it's so helpful, Nick. And maybe having a CVD lead in a practice or a PCN network can be helpful for advice.
And it's a great way to go with quality improvement initiatives and yep. Ties in nicely with the QOF, doesn't it? Absolutely. I think that's really important.
Have a look at our Essential Knowledge Updates e-learning module on the college website, also our BJGP paper, which summarizes a lot of what we've talked about today. And really to say thanks, Nick, for your time and all your work in this area.
Thanks, Tom. Lovely talking to you. And yeah, I hope people find the online papers that we publish really helpful alongside that.
You were listening to RCGP podcast. My name was Dr. Thomas Round. Thank you so much for listening.